Last week, we were... I was looking for my notes. I don't want to hand out the one with all my handwritten notes on it because you can't read my notes. You can't read my writing. Last week, we were talking about questions and hope, casting burdens and sufferings. And we talked predominantly about casting burdens. If anyone needs anything from last week, I have them here. We went through the questions about casting burdens, and then we were at the point of talking about suffering this evening. You forgot. Well, not today. Well, you got a lot of brass. Well, you're just going to have to buckle up, right? Okay. Anybody else? They're here. Okay. Seems like every time we turn around, we're hearing of people who are suffering, people who have burdens to bear. And we talked last week about burdens. And burdens are things that sometimes we don't have any control over. And the things that we have to eventually determine that we're going to bear and live through them. And yet we don't have to do that by ourselves. There are some things that we have to live through by ourselves and bear. In fact, we're told in Galatians 6 that we are to bear our own burdens, but then we're also told we're to bear one another's burdens. And in doing so, we fulfill the law of Christ by doing that. And we talked some about those burdens. We also talked about the statement in Psalm 55:22, cast your burdens upon the Lord. And we're not, that doesn't mean that when we do so, they all disappear. Right? Because we still sometimes have to bear the burdens and the consequences of those things. We don't lose all of our burdens, such as Paul's thorn in the flesh or Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane or so many others that you might, about whom you might know, even in our own lives, people that we've known who have borne up under heavy burdens. And yet, you know, they continue to go on. So we don't lose all our burdens, but we do find that we can trust God and God's presence more as we go along through that, and we find that God is helping us to bear those burdens. You know, when Jesus says in the model prayer, and lead us not into temptation, or the word also means trial, but deliver us from evil, or the evil one, it's not that he was saying we need to ask God to never let us have any kind of trial or temptation or burden, because that would not be life in this real world. But rather, that we should ask God to be with us and for us to recognize that God is with us and help us through those times of trial and temptation and burden to the other side. And sometimes we can wonder where God is and all that. Sometimes we wonder how much we can take. As I sometimes say to folks who are really have a whole lot going on and it just seems like something else is happening, you know, I say, you know, I know it seems like you've got a full plate and you sure don't need a dessert plate. But there are those who are wanting to help you get through this, and God's definitely here. Although sometimes you might say, okay, Lord, you know, people tell me all the time, well, you know, he'll never burden you with more than you can handle. Well, there are times that I want to say, are you sure? I mean, not are you sure when you say that to me, but I want to look to God and say, are you sure? You know, are you sure I can handle this? Kind of thing. As Bill Tuck says, casting your burdens upon the Lord is not a stoic approach that says, okay, grit your teeth and bear it. But rather it's to draw upon the power that can sustain you beyond your own strength or the efforts of others. God is present with you to help bear the load of pain, suffering, ache, or sorrow. And we know those kinds of things. But then when it comes to suffering, we oftentimes wonder, have you ever wondered or asked the question, why? I think we all have. Why? Why did this happen? Whether it was something that was terribly devastating or something that was just seriously annoying, but why did it happen? Of course, we tend to do so more when there is a severe tragedy that happens. And as we ended last time, we just kind of briefly used the story about Leslie Weatherhead in India, and I'll remind that again in a moment. But the quick, easy answer that a lot of folks give is it's God's will. And we often pray for God's will to be done, in a model prayer. One of those lines is, let your will be done or come to pass. Let your kingdom come. Let your will be done. As in heaven, also upon earth. What we're really asking is that God will make the earth more like heaven. That God will exercise His kingship and lordship upon the earth more like the heaven. But the quick, easy answer is, okay, it's God's will. Don't question it. Accept it. Someday you'll understand. And sometimes that seems to be a comfort. But for some folks, that's not a long-term fix. It's not a long-term fix. Because you still wonder why. We've got the stories here. Two missionaries' children had diphtheria. Both prayed for healing and recovery. One lived and one died, and their friends tried to console them by saying, oh, well, it was God's will. You shouldn't question it. You should be happy with the one you've got left. Or I stood in a line one time, and I've shared this before, I think, but I stood in a line one time, and I at a funeral home where a child had died unexpectedly, and the mother is standing there and siblings and everything, and they're devastated. And I know that the woman who made this statement was trying to be helpful. But the woman who looked at her and said, I know that you don't understand, but you know it was God's will. He just needed another little angel to help him. And she lost it. If he needs another angel, let him make another angel. Why would he take my child to be an angel? He can make angels. I know the woman was trying to help. A lot of times it's better not open your mouth and just be there than to say something that can make things worse. But those questions, she was trying to be helpful. It's God's will. And yet, how do we explain how do you explain God's will? It's God's will that suffering come because a child is taken away. Or suffering come because a spouse is taken away unexpectedly. Or suffering come in any number of ways. Phillips Brooks said, if someone should tell me that he could explain the mystery of evil and suffering, I'll close my ears to that offer. Because who of us can really fully explain? It might give comfort, but is it really adequate to say it's God's will? And I'm not the only one with an idea here, so please feel free to respond. The story I told at the end of last time, which fits in with this, I guess, is where Leslie Weatherhead, the minister and missionary, was in India. There was a father grieving over his son who had died, young son who had died from a cholera epidemic. And the father said, it's the will of God, that's all there is to it, I must accept it. Now his daughter, about the same age, I think a little bit younger, was sleeping nearby on the porch inside a mosquito net. And Weatherhead looked at her and then looked at the man and said, suppose someone crept up the stairs onto the veranda while you were sleeping and deliberately put a wad of cotton soaked with cholera germ in your little girl's mouth. What do you think about that? And the father immediately reacted and said, my God, what would I think? If he attempted and I caught him, I would kill him with little compunction as I would a snake. What do you mean by suggesting such a thing? At which point Weatherhead said, but John, isn't that what you have just accused God of doing when you said it was God's will that your son die? One of the most fatalistic religions out there is Islam, because everything, one of the most repeated phrases is inshallah. If it's Allah's will. If God wills it. And that goes from everything to what we're going to eat, to where we're going to go, what we want to do, what we want to do with life. We'll go to the mall tonight, inshallah, if it's God's will. So if we get there, it's God's will. If we don't, then it was God's will that we not get there. So everything is the will of God and the determination of God, not persons. And the only way that you can live a productive life and live a happy life, according to Islam, is to overcome ignorance. Ignorance is the root of all evil. And the way to do that is to overcome that ignorance is to submit to Allah and realize that Islam is the only true religion and the only true truth. I kind of disagree, but it's very fatalistic. Everything is the will of God. And yet we have Christians for whom everything seems, if it's unexplainable, it's got to be God's will. Even if it's tragedy. And I don't know how you feel about that. I don't know if you agree or disagree with that. Okay, if that's a good question, Sybil. If everything is God's will, was it His will that Adam and Eve sinned? And there are actually a couple of different views in extreme Calvinism, this whole idea of predestination. One's infralapsarianism and one's supralapsarianism. Two big words, one of which means God created human beings, gave them the ability to choose, and once God saw what they were going to choose, then God predetermined all the outcomes after that. Because God didn't know ahead of time anyway. Yeah. The other one is that God predestined everything, including the fall of humanity, the sin of humanity, in order that God could show His magnanimous love to some. And as my son who left the shower a while ago, as my son said one time in, I think it was high school, he and a friend of his or acquaintance of his were, at least this was David's story, and I trust him on this, but he said they were talking about religion and debating about those kinds of things. And I taught my son to play the devil's advocate on a lot of things growing up. And so David was asking questions, and this guy said, David did ask him, well, does that mean, same question you did, does that mean that God made Adam and Eve fall? And this guy said, basically, yes, everything, including the fall, was predetermined by God so that God could choose some to be saved and show His love to some. And David said, well, why in the world would I want to be, why would I want to follow a God like that? What makes Him any different from the Roman or Greek gods or any others that just do something on a whim? I thought that was a pretty good answer. That's a pretty deep answer for a high school kid to make. We say God is a God of love, and as we've talked about a number of times, if God is a God of love and God is love, is love that is forced truly love, or is that which is, does it have to be chosen to truly be love? And if God is a God of love and enforces us to love God or do God's will on everything, is that truly a loving God? So that's a very good question. And that's kind of how those are two of the arguments that have been given by Calvinists over the centuries and some others to try and explain just that question. And one is, well, no, God didn't predetermine the fall, but once God saw that people were going to make the bad choices, then God predestined who was going to be saved, who wasn't, and what the outcomes were going to be. Or, yes, God, who was creator, predestined everything so that then God could show His love to some so that they'd be grateful. Which then begs the question, I guess, does that mean that God just did it so He could feel good about Himself? And so, you know, that whole thing of it's God's will, all of this bad is God's will. Well, you can read in a lot of mythologies about how there were gods that did bad things to people just because they felt like doing it. So is that really a good God? A God that truly cares about His creation? Those are the questions that come up. And yet, you know, and sometimes we think, oh, well, these are just philosophical things to be kept in classrooms. No, because when you get out here and something happens to somebody and they wonder if it's God's will, and how could a God be good to do this to somebody? That's a real question that people ask in those situations. Which then brings us here to be under suffering. We need to wrestle with the question, if we're going to be honest with ourselves and with God, the question why, and recognize that really, probably no easy answer exists. Bill Tuck suggests three different ways to do this. Bill Tuck's a smart guy. I know Bill Tuck. To deal with the hard questions of suffering and why. First of all, we need to have an adequate concept of God. If the suffering is vengeful and vindictive, and God is deliberately sending suffering, pain, cancer, etc., then God is just like, he didn't put it this way, I'm summarizing his thought. Then God is just like a cosmic Shylock. Y'all remember Shylock in the Shakespearean plays? And Shylock demanded his pound of flesh. And when people had to pay him back, he demanded it. And what he wanted to do was, literally, he wanted to cut that pound of flesh from as near the heart as possible. If you couldn't pay him, he demanded his pound of flesh. And what Tuck says is, then if it's God's will, then God wants to bring suffering into our lives. The way that I summarized it, the image that came to me was, if God deliberately sends this suffering on us, then God is like that cosmic Shylock, demanding his pound of flesh. I've done this for you, and I've given you this, and I've given you these opportunities, and now you need to pay. He brought the flood. But did he bring the flood because he had decided he was going to do all this kind of stuff and kill folks off? Or did he bring the flood as a consequence of their poor choices? Was it his desire and will to bring the flood? Or was it sorrowfully done because of poor choices? That's a very good question, Robert. If you go, and those that are highly predeterministic in their approach would say, well, you know, that's how God planned it all. And there wasn't any other way around it. But I think the question, or what God says in Genesis chapter 6. Well, he caused it to straighten out, but that was the consequence of the other. He didn't bring it just because he wanted to in demanding his pound of flesh. But in Genesis chapter 6, before that, in the creation account in Genesis 1, the priestly account, everything, and there was evening and there was morning one day, and God said it was good, and there was evening and there was morning a second day. Then he finally gets to the last period of creation, and after creating humanity, the text says, and God looked and saw that it was very good. But notice God didn't say it was perfect. It was very good. I guess in some people's minds, perfection would be if he made it so that there'd never be anything that would go wrong, which means we wouldn't have choice. But he saw that it was very good, not perfect, but very good. Bless you. I have known people who said that freedom of choice was the greatest curse that God ever gave to us. And I tend to think of it. I mean, you can think of it that way. I tend to think of free choice as the greatest compliment God could pay. I'm going to take a chance on you. I know you're going to make some bad decisions, but I'm going to give you the ability to do this and to choose to love or not, choose to obey or not. I mean, think of it. The God that created the universe said, I'm going to make you free. But all that, it was very good, very good, very good. Then you got all this other stuff going on. People, brothers killing brothers. All kinds of other people killing and dying. And then chapter 6, when people began to multiply on the face of the ground and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that they were fair and they took wives for themselves of all that they chose. Then the Lord said, my spirit shall not abide in mortals forever, for they are flesh. Their days shall be 120 years. Now, why is he doing that? Because of the evil thoughts and the evil actions. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days and also afterward when the sons of God went to the daughters of men who bore children to them. These were the heroes that were of old, warriors of renown. And the Lord saw that the wickedness of humankind was great in the earth, and that every inclination of the thoughts of their hearts was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that He made humankind on the earth, and it grieved Him to His heart. He brings the flood to destroy, not because He wanted to, not because He said, hey, I'm going to get some kicks here, but rather out of grief to try and set things right. But it was the consequence of their hearts are only evil continually. I mean, it's pretty bad for God to say it's very good, and then over here, however many decades or millennia that was later, basically what God said, He looks around and He says, I'm sorry that I ever made these sorry scutters and put them down here. And it grieved Him to His heart. So, it's not that God deliberately sent this stuff demanding His pound of flesh, but He sent it out. I mean, Shylock enjoyed what he was doing. But rather, out of grief, God brought that suffering. And in grief, that suffering was allowed to happen. But if it's God's will to want to bring suffering, But here it says He didn't want to do it. It was something that evolved out of or came out of the consequences of all that evil that was chosen. And really, as Christians who speak of God's love in Jesus and through Jesus Christ, can we really espouse that God sends evil and suffering? If He loves us, I mean, yes, sometimes we punish our children, but we don't do it because we like doing it or we want to do it. That's just like Tony Berardo. Still remember his name. Tony Berardo. Tony Berardo was a student in class, and one day he came up, and I guess, you know, I had only been teaching it in northern Greenville County for a few years, well, several, but had him in class, and he came running up to me one day after class, and he said, Professor Hearn, now, I've been thinking about some of the stuff that you've been teaching here and been asking us to think about, and I've been listening to the radio and to this fantastic preacher. He preaches on all the fundamentals, and just Oliver B. Green, he's absolutely wonderful, and you need to listen to Oliver B. Green. I didn't know who Oliver B. Green was at the time. Found out later. He was dead, but he was still preaching on the radio. He's still dead, and he still preaches on the radio from what I understand. David Green with the Green Law Firm, little short guy, it's his son. He makes sure that it stays on there. But he said, and he really lays out the fundamentals. You need to get and listen. I said, Tony, I appreciate your concern, but you know, you got to be really careful because a lot of times people who say that they know the fundamentals and they're going to tell you what the fundamentals are and there's no question. I said, sometimes they actually mess you up by doing that because they really don't know how to deal with the fundamental questions. At which point he said, I can't believe you. God is going to punish you for laying your long tongue on His man. Okay. A week or so later, I was practicing for a faculty versus student basketball game in the gym on a Sunday afternoon. And I went up for a rebound. A guy up the top of the key said it sounded like this. I grabbed that rebound. There was a snap. I let go of the ball, and I did that right there and stopped my Achilles from rolling up completely up the back of my leg. It had completely ruptured. Went to the hospital in the ER. After a while, a resident there kept, he said, you mind if I keep bringing these people? I've never seen a completely ruptured Achilles tendon before. So I'm laying, I said, sure, I said, and finally, after about the fourth or fifth person he brought in, I said, and that's when you bring in, I'm going to charge admission. I laughed. He said, no, the next one's going to see you is going to charge you admission because it's Dr. Vic Campbell, and he's on his way. And he did. Well, My friend Jim Pitts told me later on that Tony Berardo, Pitts was on campus, and Tony Berardo went running up to him and said, Dr. Pitts, he knew he was a chaplain at Furman and taught at Furman, he said, don't you think that it's wonderful that God got Dr. Hearn and tore up his leg for laying his long, slanderous tongue on God's man? Jim said, I looked at him and said, Tony? Because he introduced himself. That's why he knew his name. He didn't know. He said, Tony? You know, if God had the time to go about and do that kind of stuff, neither you nor me would be standing here talking. Because we wouldn't be here. By the way, several years later, I got a letter from Tony Berardo in the mail, and he was working in a halfway house in Florida. And he apologized profusely for that. He said, I hope you can forgive me for the way I was, but I've learned in the years since that you were more right than I was. Yes. Yes. But, you know, there are people who think, you know, tragedy happens, well, it's God's finger. Tragedy happens, well, God decided that this person, he really didn't like, or they had done something he didn't like, and so he's going to send them off into the ravine and let them smash a tree, and all that kind of stuff. But as Christians who speak about God's love, in and through Jesus, is it really an adequate concept of God that He is vengeful and vindictive, and the reason we follow Him is so that He doesn't hit us with a lightning bolt and bring suffering into our lives? That's a real question. Also, Tuck suggests we have to have an adequate concept of the universe and the laws that govern the universe. Quote here, God has created our universe so that it is a law-abiding realm. And we've got laws of gravity, polarity, all kinds of things. If the natural realm had no dependable laws, then we could not know from one moment to the next whether the chair we're sitting in would hold us up or suddenly change to something else, or we might go floating off into space. If God is good and God made the universe with order, and Genesis 1 says that there was chaos, and into that chaos God brought order and good and light and life. In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was moving over the face of the waters. Dark, malevolent, chaotic sea. Whether it's water, as they said, or it's dark, chaotic, malevolent space. And into that, God brings order and good and light. And He puts together all of this. It's interesting that as early as the time that was written, probably around 587 or so B.C., when it was actually written down, but even before that, the stories and ideas were going around. God makes the sun, the greater light to govern the day and the lesser light to govern the night and the stars, and He sets them over to number days and months and years and to set times and seasons. Even then, the ancient mind recognized that there was order in what was out there and in what God created. Even the seasons of the year and the times and the growing season and all of that. So, if God did indeed create a natural universe in which for us to live that is governed by dependable laws, then we have to learn how to live within those laws and not test them too far. Gene comes flying down the hill in his car. He starts at the top. He's burning those tires all the way down the hill. He makes that curve right there, and I'm standing near that big oak tree. And just as he goes to make the curve, I go, ha! Well, what's the natural law of the universe say is going to happen? That's right. I'm going to mess up the front of his car, but I'm gone. I'm gone. That's tempting the natural law and the order that was put in there. And I really think a lot of times things that happen to us and we say, oh, they're suffering, is because we pushed the boundaries too far. I think I might have said last time, but if not, I'll say it tonight, and if I did, I'll say it again. And I know people that die 95 years old and have smoked all their life and there's no evidence of lung cancer. But my father, who I still love dearly, smoked cigarettes most of his life. Early on, he did smoke Pall Malls. He didn't smoke Camels, but they were not filtered. He smoked cigarettes. We kept trying to get him as he got older. No. Had two cigarettes left, smoked one on his way to the golf course in November. On his way to the golf course, smoked the other one on the first tee box. Said, you know, this is stupid. I've been wasting all this money. I'm going to quit. In February, they found his lung cancer, and 2.5 years later, he was dead. Now, do I think God said, nah, this Tommy's time. I'm going to zzz. No. My father abused the system. He smoked way too much for way too long, and it caught up with him. Yeah, he was one of those that as soon as you stepped out, I mean, you had to go through the smoke cloud if you went outside. To walk around the church from Sunday school to go in the front doors, you had to go through that cloud of smoke. Right? Now, there's people that are 95 years old. They die of something, they do an autopsy, and I've been there and people said, well, I guess they had, no, didn't have, a little bit of emphysema, but no lung cancer, but they died of this. But, you know, I still think you can push it too far, and in my father's case, that's what happened. But yeah, he was a deacon, and he was one of the deadly deacons. You know, they would get that whole cigarette in during that time. And I know there are people in here that smoke. Don't get your lung cancer. I want you around a long time. Okay, the things that I do. By the way, I had lost a bunch of weight and kept it off. And since we went to Disney in November, I put on 10 pounds and hadn't been able to keep it off. And like we ate down here, we ate the buffet at lunch. And I ate the breakfast buffet, and then I went through the regular buffet, and then I had dessert. And then right over here, I wasn't hungry, but when they had that shower, I ate a little bit of just about everything, except the pickle sandwiches. I don't do that. Everything on the table. Right? Or, you know, I mean, so God made the universe, and it works a certain way. High cholesterol, clogged arteries, and sometimes that still doesn't work. So, you know, I mean, no, there are all kinds of things we could use. But God made it good, but not perfect in our imagined standards. But God gives free will and doesn't deny us the right or the ability to exercise that free will, even when it comes to natural laws. So, Tuck's suggestion is to deal with the question is, first of all, we've got to have an adequate concept of God. And secondly, an adequate concept of the universe. That God had the power and loves us enough to have created this for us and in which for us to live and to relate with each other. But sometimes the suffering that happens is because we push the limits of the natural laws. Or we go against them. By the way, if I jumped out in front of Gene's car and all of a sudden a big hand, I'd be awfully prideful to think that God had reached down and snatched me up. But if a big hand came out of the sky and snatched me up, it'd have the same effect. I'd die of a heart attack. But you know, we've got all those different kinds of things. So even when we go against the natural laws, God gives us the right and the ability to do that. And sometimes the suffering is what we bring upon ourselves. In fact, a lot of times suffering is what we bring upon ourselves. Or suffering is not what we bring upon ourselves, but someone else exercises their free choice in a way that it brings suffering to us. But why should I have free choice and someone else not? If God is truly God and God is truly a loving God. And so that, you know, that may or may not help us in dealing with it, but these are a couple of possibilities here. The third is to deal with the power of God. In Archibald MacLeish's play, J.B., which is obviously about Job, at one point the suffering Job says, one of the characters says, if God is God, he's not good. If God is good, he's not God. Why? Because of all the suffering that's there. In other words, the old thing, if God is all powerful, can God make a rock that's too big and heavy for God to even pick up? Yeah, you may or may not have heard that one, but I heard that way years ago. But in JB, the question is, if God is truly God, then God can't be good if there's suffering in the world, because God can stop the suffering. And if God is truly good, but there's suffering in the world, then God can't be God, because he could have stopped the suffering in the world. But, as Chuck says, Jesus Christ has revealed to us God is good, but this does not imply that a good God has not set some limits upon that power. God did not spare Jesus from suffering, pain, and death, did he? Could have. Didn't. God has created the world in such a way that there is no possibility of good without the possibility of evil. I mean, how would we know it was good if there wasn't something bad out there against which to judge it? How would we know it was bad if there wasn't good? Go back to the old example I've used before of George Burns in the movie Oh God, Book 2, where the little girl's running away from home because she can't stand it, because she came up with the slogan, Thank God, and everybody thinks she's crazy, including her parents. Well, she's seen God. Well, not everybody. A few of her classmates help her. And she's running away from home. And I can't remember if it's the bus station or the train station, but George Burns shows up as God, in character beside her in the seat. And he finally convinces her. She doesn't want to go home. Everybody thinks I'm crazy. He finally convinces her to leave. And as they're leaving and heading out, she asks him the question. She wants to know. Why is there so much pain and suffering? Why do kids get sick and die? Why do other people hurt other people? And the answer is thoroughly Jewish that George Burns gives. Surprise. But the answer in character that he gives, he says, well, you know, I never could create anything with just one side to it. You don't have a front without a back, a top without a bottom, pleasure without pain. How would you know that it was pleasureful if there wasn't something against which to judge it? Tuck says, God has created the world in such a way there's no possibility of good without the possibility of evil. And really, if you think about free choice, the choices are obedience or disobedience, or as some would say, good and evil. Within Judaism, there's also the idea that to choose the lesser, you have different levels of good sometimes, and to choose less than the best is to make an evil choice or a sinful choice because you've chosen less than what is the best. Which really makes it tough for us, doesn't it? If we really think about it. God has created this kind of world because without freedom, there is no potential for growth. Without freedom, there is no potential for choice. So what he's saying here is that God has chosen to allow these things to happen, while God could stop all of the suffering and all of the bad choices to make us always choose the right thing. That's predeterminism. And does that allow for the true possibility of love and care? In order to truly experience love, we have to take the chance to experience being unloved. And only in that do we really know what true love is. And so, while God did not send the pain, disease, or tragedy, God is present with us. God allows people to make choices, and if those choices bring pain, the power of God is still present with us in such a way that God can help us through the suffering and help us to not just survive, but to grow through the suffering, even through the burdens and sufferings. Romans 8:28. For we know what? God works together. Now, this one is where we find that God works for good for those who are called to His purpose, according to His purpose. Romans 8:28. We know that all things work together for good for those who love God, who are called according to His purpose. And I would say, who accept that call. All things work together for good. Does that mean that everything's going to be good all the time? No. But that does mean that even in that pain and in that suffering, if we work with God and with and trust in God, God in His power can work even through that difficulty something that turns out to be good. He can take those bad decisions that we make and bring us through on the other side wiser, maybe scarred, but wiser and in a better place. And maybe better able to understand and help someone else get through the suffering that might be similar. What's the difference in sympathy and empathy? That's right, Hazel. Empathy means that you have had a similar experience and you know what that feeling is like. Sympathy, you can be sympathetic for someone and feel badly for them. But empathy means you feel more than just badly for them. You, in some way, on some level, experience the same thing they are because you have been there. And so when we are rejected, when people say horrible things about us, when people make fun of us, when people persecute us in various ways, whether it's for religious reasons or not, guess what? People made fun of Jesus. People persecuted Jesus. People killed Jesus. God in Jesus can truly empathize because God in Jesus has been there. But guess what? Even before Jesus came, God chose people and said, I want to have a special relationship with you out of all these people on the earth. And I want to do these things for you and help you and then have you help them to understand who I am. And what did they constantly do? Spit in his face. Rejected him. That's right, Jim. Rejected him. In other words, they made fun of God. There are a lot of things that happen, whether we cause them or other forces cause them. And immediately people ask God, why did you do this? God gets blamed for a whole lot of things that God didn't have anything to do with. Yeah, I mean, those guys made a conscious decision to do something that was going to cause suffering. And yet, in the middle of all of that, you know, people say, where was God? Well, God was everywhere. Why didn't God stop it? If God was truly God, God could have stopped it. Well, yeah, but that's not the world that God has set up, and that overrides free choice. And sometimes the free choices are good, and sometimes they're bad. But you're right. The important thing is to recognize that in the middle of all of that, God is with us. And that nothing, once again, Romans 8, nothing in all creation has the power, nothing and no one in all creation has the power to separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus, except us. We can do it by rejecting Him. We can do it by turning our backs on Him. But nothing else, there's no other power out there. We can choose to turn from His redemptive, restorative grace. But God's power is there for us to call upon to help us in and through the suffering. And so the quick, easy answer is, oh, it's God's will. Let's go on about our business and try and forget about it. And then we find out later that answer is not adequate. Or we can constantly be thinking about God and God, who is God? How powerful is God? What of God's power? What does God want for us? And how do we and our decisions connect with God in such a way that when suffering comes, when somebody else makes a bad decision that affects us, or if we make a bad decision that affects us or someone else, that God is present, God's power is there to guide us and to heal us, even though we still have to suffer the consequences. And that we do that all within the context, not just a spiritual context, but a physical context of the world in which we live, that God gave us and gave laws by which it's governed. If it's all random and chaos, then how in the world can we count on the law of gravity? The law of polar opposites. And all the other things that keep us alive and keep us from floating off into space. I'm constantly amazed at the folks that say, oh, it's all chance, it's all chance, it's all chance, there is no God. And yet, how do you account for the order when you don't see the same order on Mercury or Venus or Mars or Saturn or any place else? And Pluto, well, it even lost being a planet, right? According to us. And yet it's something that God created for a purpose. Casting burdens, dealing with suffering, these are not easy questions or easy issues. And anyone who tells you they are, I guess like Phillips Brooks, I really don't want to hear that. Older I get, as I am often wont to say, the older I get, the more gray the world becomes and has nothing to do with my hair. But it has everything to do with seeing things in a new way, in a different light, and trying to find where I fit in with God and with others as I go along that journey. And sometimes that means suffering. Were you just stretching your glasses or going to say something? Okay. I didn't want to cut out any questions or comments. Well, go figure. I ran over about 7 minutes. But I do thank y'all and look forward to continuing our conversations in a variety of different ways. God bless you. Go in peace. Amen.